Hey, before your Q3 call, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Great. Did you include the differentiation angle the CMO asked for?
Already in there. Three angles no competitor's using right now. Just need your approval.
Approved. Thanks. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On the morning of the 22nd of December, 1978, investigators returned to the house on West Somerdale Avenue with a second search warrant. Less than 24 hours earlier, John Wayne Gacy had quietly admitted to his lawyer that Robert Peast was no longer alive. Detectives didn't know that. They were still hoping to find some trace of the missing teenager. Instead, they found something else. The opening beneath the hallway floor measured little more than 60 centimeters high. One by one, detectives lowered themselves into the cramped crawl space, their flashlights cutting through the darkness. The earth beneath the house had been disturbed repeatedly over the years. But it wasn't until one investigator noticed what appeared to be a human arm protruding from the soil that the full significance of the search became apparent. Within hours, archaeologists, forensic specialists, and medical examiners had been called to the scene. Detectives quickly realized that the recovery would not take a day. All up, retrieving the remains of all his victims would take close to 3 weeks. You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thanks for listening to our podcast. For an ad-free experience, join us on Patreon, starting at just $2 a month, with 25% of the proceeds supporting the Doe Network, helping to bring closure to international cold cases. Our episodes cover true crimes involving real people, and some content may be graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised. We produce each episode with the utmost respect for the victims, their families, and loved ones. Before we dive in, if you enjoy our stories and prefer reading at your own pace, check out the Evidence Locker Files book collection, all researched and written for the podcast, now available in print and digital formats. Find the collection on Amazon or visit our website at evidencelockerpodcast.com/books for more. By the time investigators returned to 8213 West Somerdale Avenue on the morning of the 22nd of December, the search for Robert Peast had changed beyond recognition. 10 days earlier, detectives had been trying to establish whether a missing 15-year-old had accepted a lift from a stranger after finishing work. Now, they were preparing to execute a second search warrant at the home of the man who had become the center of their investigation. News of the renewed search spread quickly. Police vehicles lined the quiet suburban street as neighbors gathered behind barricades, watching detectives carry cameras, evidence boxes, and excavation equipment into the modest brick ranch house. Few could have imagined that the property, so ordinary in appearance, would soon become one of the most closely examined crime scenes in American history. Inside, investigators returned to the narrow crawl space beneath the house. Access was gained through a small opening concealed beneath a hatch in the hallway floor, barely 60 centimeters high in places. The space forced investigators to crawl on their hands and knees through damp earth and supporting beams. The air was stale, heavy, and carried an unpleasant odor that several detectives had noticed during earlier visits to the house. Gacy had dismissed it as dampness, sewage problems, or perhaps a dead rodent beneath the floorboards. It was an explanation that had seemed plausible enough at the time. Now, they intended to determine its source. Armed with flashlights, investigators began examining the disturbed soil beneath the house. Almost immediately, they noticed that sections of the crawl space appeared inconsistent with the surrounding earth. Some areas looked as though they had been dug out and refilled. Others contained patches of loose soil that differed in color and texture from the undisturbed clay around them. One such area drew particular attention. As investigators carefully removed the upper layer of soil, fragments of decayed material began appearing underneath the surface. At first, it was impossible to say exactly what they were looking at. then someone noticed what appeared to be human bone. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office was contacted, along with forensic specialists experienced in the recovery of human remains. Detectives understood immediately that this was no longer simply a search warrant. The house had become an active homicide scene. What followed over the next several days bore little resemblance to a conventional police search. Rather than digging indiscriminately, investigators approached the crawl space as though excavating an archaeological site. Each section of disturbed ground was photographed before being carefully exposed by hand. Soil was removed layer by layer, every discovery mapped, measured, and recorded before anything was disturbed further. Narrow pathways were established beneath the house, so investigators could move without contaminating potential evidence, while outside, forensic personnel erected temporary work areas to receive and catalog recovered remains. It quickly became apparent that the first grave was not an isolated burial. Only a short distance away, investigators located another, and then another. As each burial site was uncovered, the same painstaking process began again. Photographs were taken, measurements recorded. Human remains were carefully lifted from the confined space before being transferred to the medical examiner's office, where forensic anthropologists and odontologists worked to establish the identities of the dead. The recovery continued throughout the Christmas period. While most families across Chicago prepared for the holidays, detectives, crime scene technicians, and forensic specialists spent long days beneath the house on West Somerdale Avenue. The work was physically exhausting. The confined crawl space allowed little room to maneuver, and investigators often lay on their stomachs for hours at a time while carefully exposing remains that had lain undisturbed for years. Outside, media interest intensified with each passing day. Television crews established positions along the street. Newspaper photographers documented every vehicle entering and leaving the property, and neighbors watched in disbelief as stretchers carrying evidence emerged from the house. Officially, investigators revealed very little, but it was becoming increasingly obvious that the search for Robert Peast had uncovered something far more significant than anyone had anticipated. For detectives who spent the previous 10 days searching for one missing teenager, the scale of the discovery was almost impossible to comprehend. Each new grave raised the same troubling question: who did these remains belong to? Some would later be identified quickly through dental records and missing person reports. Others would remain unknown for years, known only by the location in which they had been found beneath the house. Families across Illinois and neighboring states watched the unfolding investigation with growing dread, wondering whether sons, brothers, and friends who had disappeared months or even years earlier might somehow be connected to the quiet suburban address that now dominated the national news. While investigators continued excavating beneath the house, John Wayne Gacy sat in an interview room at the Cook County Sheriff's Office. He had been arrested the previous day on an outstanding charge of possessing marijuana, giving detectives the opportunity to keep him in custody while the search continued.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Throughout the day, detectives moved between the crime scene and the interview room, comparing each new discovery with the man sitting before them. Gacy was no longer the composed contractor who had calmly dismissed investigators' questions during the previous week. He knew what lay beneath his house, and with every passing hour, he understood that the excavation was bringing detectives closer to the truth. Rather than confronting him with accusations, investigators allowed Gacy to speak freely. The conversations wandered from his childhood to his business, his marriage, his political ambitions, and the pressures he believed had shaped his life. Detectives listened patiently, interrupting only to clarify details or gently steer him back towards Robert Peast. It was a technique that required patience. Experienced investigators understood that silence often achieved more than confrontation. As the hours passed, Gacy's confidence began to ebb. He remarked more than once that his life was over, and according to those present, quietly described himself as a dead man. It was the first indication that he understood the gravity of the discoveries being made beneath his home. Then, almost imperceptibly, the conversation shifted. Without any dramatic declaration or emotional outburst, Gacy acknowledged that Robert Peast was dead. Gacy explained that the teenager had never left the house. According to his account, he had shown Robert his handcuff trick, restrained him, and then strangled him with a length of rope, using the method he called his rope trick. It was a story whose details would shift repeatedly over the months and years that followed. But investigators listening that day were less concerned with how Gacy said Robert died than with where his body could be found. He told them the body had been kept in the house overnight before he drove it to a bridge over the Des Plaines River and dropped it into the water in the early hours of the following morning. Confusingly, Gacy also told detectives that day that he had killed a young man in self-defense years earlier and buried that victim under his garage floor. A separate case investigators would later confirm involved a former employee named John Butkovich, not Robert Peast. Untangling which account belonged to which victim would occupy investigators for days. What was becoming increasingly apparent, however, was that Gacy's recollection of individual victims was unreliable. Years of murder, concealment, and deception had blurred together, leaving detectives with the difficult task of separating fact from fabrication. As the interviews continued, investigators abandoned any expectation of obtaining a neat, chronological confession. Instead, they allowed Gacy to talk, carefully comparing every statement with information arriving from the crime scene. Sometimes his recollections matched what forensic teams were uncovering beneath the house. At other times, they did not. Detectives soon realized that the physical evidence would ultimately prove more reliable than the man describing it. The conversation gradually shifted from Robert Peast to other young men. At first, Gacy avoided numbers altogether. He referred vaguely to boys and employees who had come to the house over the years, offering little detail beyond suggesting that many of the deaths had followed arguments or sexual encounters that somehow escalated beyond his control. The explanations were inconsistent and often self-serving, portraying each killing as an isolated event rather than part of a sustained pattern of predatory behavior. According to detectives present during the interviews, there was a curious detachment to the way he described the killings, as though he were recounting episodes from someone else's life rather than his own. Meanwhile, the excavation continued. Each set of remains recovered from beneath the crawlspace represented another unidentified victim, another family that had spent months or years wondering what had become of a missing son or brother. Outside the house, journalists crowded behind police barricades, broadcasting live reports as forensic vehicles arrived and departed throughout the day. Neighbors who had lived alongside Gacy for years watched in disbelief as investigators carried evidence from a property that, until only days earlier, had seemed no different from any other home on the street. Inside the sheriff's office, detectives reached a point where one question could no longer be avoided. If the crawlspace was already full, where were the rest? Gacy explained that there had come a time when there was no more room beneath the house. From then on, he said, he had disposed of several victims elsewhere. Their bodies, he claimed, had been thrown from bridges into the Des Plaines River. For investigators, the statement changed the investigation yet again. Until that moment, the recovery effort had been confined to a single property. Now it expanded beyond West Summerdale Avenue, raising the possibility that victims remained undiscovered somewhere along the river system winding through metropolitan Chicago. Search teams would soon begin combing the waterways, hoping to locate those Gacy said he had discarded after the crawlspace became overcrowded. By Christmas Eve, the painstaking process of recovering victims from beneath the house was far from over, while equally challenging was the task of giving each of those young men back their names. The excavation had revealed the scale of the crimes. What investigators still did not fully understand was how an outwardly successful businessman had managed to murder so many young men over such a long period without attracting sustained suspicion. The question was no longer whether John Wayne Gacy had committed the murders. It was how he had managed to do so for so many years without arousing greater suspicion. To those who knew him, Gacy seemed like an unlikely candidate. He owned a successful construction company that employed dozens of young men throughout the Chicago area. PDM contractors had built a solid reputation, taking on everything from home renovations to larger commercial projects. And Gacy himself projected the image of a hardworking businessman who had achieved the American dream through determination and long hours. He was active in local Democratic Party politics, serving as a precinct captain and organizing community events where he became acquainted with several influential politicians. Photographs from the time show him shaking hands with civic leaders, attending fundraising dinners, and posing confidently beside public officials. Few people who met him in those settings had reason to question the persona he so carefully cultivated. Outside work, Gacy was equally engaged in community life. He volunteered at neighborhood functions and occasionally entertained children at charitable events, hospitals, and local celebrations dressed as Pogo the Clown. Contrary to popular belief, he did not earn a living as a clown, nor did he regularly perform at children's birthday parties. Pogo was simply one of several volunteer personas he adapted for community events, reflecting the civic-minded image he worked hard to protect. In the years that followed, however, the clown costume would become inseparable from his crimes, earning him the enduring nickname, the Killer Clown. A title that, while memorable, oversimplified the far more calculated deception that allowed him to hide in plain sight. Neighbors remembered him as friendly and approachable. He was known to lend tools, offer advice on home repairs, and chat comfortably across backyard fences. To many, he appeared outgoing, confident, and successful. Looking back after his arrest, several neighbors recalled little more than the occasional unpleasant smell drifting from the property during warmer weather. Gacy had explained it away as sewage problems beneath the house, and most accepted the explanation without giving it further thought. There had been no obvious screams, no suspicious comings and goings that seemed extraordinary at the time, and certainly nothing to suggest that dozens of young men had entered the house over the preceding years, never to leave again. Yet behind the carefully maintained facade was a far more complicated history, one that investigators soon discovered had not begun in suburban Chicago.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
John Wayne Gacy was born on the 17th of March, 1942, in Chicago, Illinois. The second of three children born to John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robison. The family lived in a modest working-class neighborhood where appearances mattered and discipline was strict. Gacy later described his childhood as deeply unhappy, dominated by a father whose violent temper cast a long shadow over his family life. John Stanley Gacy was a machinist and World War I veteran who struggled with alcoholism. Friends and relatives later described him as domineering and unpredictable, prone to explosive outbursts directed at both his wife and children. John Jr. appeared to bear the brunt of that anger. Throughout his childhood, he was frequently belittled, beaten, and mocked by his father, who questioned his masculinity and dismissed him as weak. The criticism intensified whenever Gacy displayed interests his father considered insufficiently masculine, or whether ill health prevented him from participating in sport alongside other boys. Those health problems were genuine. Around age 11, Gacy was struck in the head by a swing at school, and for several years afterward, he has suffered periodic blackouts, eventually traced to a blood clot that required medical treatment. While other children played outside, he spent long periods indoors recovering, often feeling isolated from his peers. The extent to which this episode affected his later behavior has remained the subject of considerable debate. Modern researchers generally agree that no single childhood event can explain the development of a serial killer. Instead, Gacy's upbringing forms part of a far more complex picture in which personality, environment, and individual choice became intertwined over many years. By the spring of 1980, investigators had completed one of the largest homicide investigations in Illinois history. The excavation of Gacy's property, the recovery of victims from the Des Plaines River, and months of painstaking forensic work had enabled authorities to identify most of the young men who had disappeared over the previous decade. Their names were slowly returned to them through dental records, medical histories, and in some cases, the tireless persistence of families who would never stop searching. On the 6th of February, 1980, John Wayne Gacy went on trial in the Circuit Court of Cook County. Prosecutors charged him with the murders of 33 young men and boys, making it one of the largest multiple murder prosecutions the United States had ever seen. The trial lasted more than 5 weeks, yet it brought together years of investigation, hundreds of witnesses, and thousands of exhibits. For prosecutors, the central issue was straightforward. Gacy had confessed to numerous murders. Investigators had recovered the victims from beneath his home, and forensic evidence linked him directly to the crimes. The defense, however, pursued a very different strategy. Gacy's lawyers did not dispute that the killings had occurred. Instead, they argued that their client was legally insane. Under Illinois law at the time, a defendant could not be held criminally responsible if, because of a mental disease or defect, he lacked the capacity to appreciate the criminality of his actions or conform his behavior to the law. The defense called several psychiatrists who testified that Gacy suffered from severe personality disorders and displayed characteristics consistent with multiple personalities, suggesting that an alternate persona had committed the murders while the outwardly respectable businessman remained psychologically detached. The prosecution countered with its own psychiatric experts, who reached a very different conclusion. They acknowledged that Gacy displayed traits associated with narcissistic and antisocial personality disorders, but maintained that he was fully aware of his actions. The elaborate precautions he took to lure victims, conceal their bodies, and mislead investigators demonstrated planning, circulation, and an understanding that what he was doing was wrong. Personality disorders, they argued, did not meet the legal threshold for insanity. Throughout the proceedings, jurors heard harrowing testimony from forensic specialists, investigators, and the families of victims whose lives have been irrevocably altered by Gacy's crimes. The physical evidence was overwhelming. Dental experts carefully explained how many of the unidentified remains had finally been matched to missing persons' reports, bringing answers to families who had spent years living with uncertainty. After deliberating for less than 2 hours, the jury rejected the insanity defense. On the 12th of March, 1980, John Wayne Gacy was found guilty on all 33 counts of murder. The following day, the jury recommended that Gacy receive the death penalty for each eligible count, and Judge Louis B. Garippo formally imposed the sentence. Gacy showed little visible emotion as the verdicts were read. Addressing the court, he continued to portray himself as the victim of circumstance, insisting that history would judge him differently, and maintaining that the legal process had become little more than a public spectacle. For the family seated throughout the courtroom, however, the verdict marked the end of a long and agonizing chapter. Some had spent years searching for sons who had simply vanished without explanation. Others had endured months of uncertainty while forensic experts worked to identify remains recovered from beneath the house on West Summerdale Avenue. Although the convictions could never restore what had been taken from them, they finally provided certainty where there had been only unanswered questions. As deputies escorted Gacy from the courtroom, the legal battle was far from over. Over the next 14 years, his lawyers would file numerous appeals, challenging both his convictions and the death sentence. Every appeal ultimately failed. In the early hours of May 10, 1994, after spending 14 years on death row at the Menard Correctional Center, John Wayne Gacy was executed by lethal injection at the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois. His reported final words reflected the defiance he displayed throughout much of his imprisonment. "Kiss my ass." With that, one of America's most notorious serial killers was dead. The convictions brought justice, but they could not bring closure to every family. Although investigators succeeded in identifying most of the young men recovered from Gacy's property, several remained unknown for decades, and some have only been identified through modern DNA technology. Others are still waiting to be named. Somewhere, families may still be wondering what became of a son, a brother, or a friend who left home one day and simply never returned. More than four decades after John Wayne Gacy's arrest, the final chapter of this case has yet to be written. If you'd like to dive deeper into this case, check out the resources we used for this episode in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on social media for more updates on today's case. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and X. We also have a channel on YouTube where you can watch more content. If you enjoy what we do here at Evidence Locker, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now and consider leaving us a 5-star review. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.
This is Amy Brown from Feeling Things with Amy and Kat. Back to school season always feels like a fresh start, not just for kids, but for all of us. It's a great reminder to create new routines and find meaningful ways to connect with our family, friends, and community. Hasbro Games make it easy to gather around the table. Put the screens away, share some laughs, and create joyful memories together. Whether it's Monopoly, Connect Four, Guess Who, or another family favorite, there's something for everyone. You can find these and other Hasbro favorites at your local Walmart, walmart.com, or simply tap the link in today's show notes to bring more play into your week.
This is Rick Burgess from The Rick Burgess Show. If you're still auto-renewing your car insurance without shopping around, you are probably throwing money away. I'm telling you, go check out Insurify. In about 2 minutes, totally free, you can compare quotes from over 100 companies all in one place. Now, here's what I love. Insurify actually monitors your rates and alerts you when prices drop, so you never miss out on a better deal. Millions of people have used it to stop overpaying, and there's no reason you shouldn't too. Do yourself a favor. See what you can save right now at Insurify.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.